Number 074058 in re Volkswagen. I'm here for Mr. Ashby.
Chief Judge Jones, and may it please the court, we would ask for 5 minutes before waiving the limit on questions. The panel here held that the district court clearly abused its discretion in deciding the 1404A transfer motion in this case. The panel reached that decision on two primary grounds. First, while correctly identifying the transfer factors, the trial court erred in its analysis and weighing of those factors.
You want to speak up a bit?
Yes, Your Honor. And second, the district court committed several errors of law, including treating the plaintiff's choice of forum as the paramount consideration under 1404A, analyzing Volkswagen's transfer motion under the stricter forum non-convene standard, and failing to apply the core legal principles set out by this court in Volkswagen 1. Before turning to the specific legal errors, there are three overriding principles that we submit the court should bear in mind in deciding this case. First, though the plaintiffs have tried to make it a point of contention, it really is beyond question that mandamus is an available remedy in 1404A cases. As the panel held, as this court has held in an unbroken line of decisions decided over the last 50 years, and as every circuit court in the country has held. Second, beyond being an available remedy, mandamus relief is proper in this case because, as the panel held, the trial court erred in its analysis of all of the FISA factors, and it fundamentally misconstrued the law in deciding Volkswagen's transfer motion. And third, the role of the plaintiff's choice of forum simply does not control the analysis in this case. Because a plaintiff's choice of forum is never sufficient in itself to warrant the denial of a transfer motion, the recognition that the plaintiff's choice carries weight has no meaningful impact, whereas here it is opposed by every other relevant factor in the analysis. That principle has special force in this case because neither the plaintiffs nor the events giving rise to this lawsuit have any connection whatsoever to Marshall. The panel opinion recognized each of these important principles. It was carefully reasoned, and it was legally and factually correct. Its results should be upheld by the en banc court, not only because it was correct, but also because it would provide clear guidance for the bench and bar in determining the standards for transfer motions going forward. With that, let me turn to the specific errors in the trial court's analysis. The panel here granted mandamus principally on the ground that the trial court abused its discretion in failing to properly analyze and weigh the transfer factors. Turning first to the public interest factors, three of those factors are neutral and don't need to be addressed here. As both the panel and the trial court correctly observed, and as is often the case, these factors do not weigh either for or against transfer. The remaining public interest factor, however, the local interest in settling local disputes, weighs heavily in favor of transfer, as the panel found. In contrast, the trial court initially found that this factor weighed against transfer and later held that the factor was neutral as to transfer. The district court's holding on this factor was wrong for two reasons. First, the parties and the witnesses have no connection to Marshall. None of the plaintiffs have ever resided in the Marshall Division, and no witness resides in the Marshall Division. And second, this case has no factual connection to Marshall. The interests of the citizens of Dallas, on the other hand, are concrete and clear. All the witnesses for the third-party defendant, the third-party claim, reside in the Northern District of Texas. The accident occurred there. Emergency medical services were provided there. The police investigation occurred there, and two of the plaintiffs reside in Dallas with a third plaintiff residing in Kansas. And the vehicle at issue was sold by a dealership in Dallas, while there is not a Volkswagen dealership in Marshall. This factor cannot be neutral, as the trial court held, simply because Marshall citizens have an interest in the sale of allegedly defective goods sold in close proximity to Marshall. If the district court's analysis is accepted, then this factor ceases to have any meaning. A district court in Alaska, for example, would have the exact same local interest in this case as does Dallas. And the panel was also correct to point out the unfairness of burdening citizens in an unrelated forum with jury duty. As citizens marshal should not be responsible for adjudicating a traffic accident that occurred on the freeways of Dallas. This public interest factor overwhelmingly favors transfer to Dallas. That leaves the private interest factors. None of those factors favor transfer or favor venue in Marshall. All of them favor transfer to Dallas. The trial court here acknowledged that all of the witnesses relevant to Volkswagen's third-party complaint live and work in the Dallas area, but held that 150 miles was not a sufficient distance to weigh in favor of transfer. That analysis is at odds with this court's decision in Volkswagen 1 that any distance more than 100 miles must be considered in analyzing the witness convenience factor. In Volkswagen 1, this court established that when the distance between an existing venue and a proposed venue is more than 100 miles, the factor of inconvenience of witnesses increases in direct relationship to the additional distance to be traveled. Here, numerous Dallas-based third-party witnesses would be forced to travel a round trip of over 300 miles to testify in Marshall. As the panel noted, numerous witnesses would be inconvenienced, including the third-party defendant, accident witnesses, accident investigators, treating medical personnel, and the medical examiner, all of whom reside in Dallas and all of whom are public servants for the city of Dallas. Volkswagen identified 15 witnesses in Dallas and provided an explanation of their potential testimony in its motion to transfer. And the plaintiffs themselves identified these witnesses in their Rule 26A disclosures as likely having discoverable information that the plaintiffs may use to support their claims. And in fact, the plaintiffs identify no less than 30 witnesses in the Dallas division who they say may be relevant to their claims. And that may be found in our appendix at page 114A. They identify no Marshall witnesses. Traveling from Dallas to Marshall is a day-long affair, waiting to testify, testifying and returning to Dallas. And in many instances, it may require an overnight stay. And there are, in that case, there are meals, potential lodging expenses, time away from work, and time away from family, again, for a number of public servants in Dallas. And even the Singletons have recognized the convenience of Dallas by filing a separate lawsuit against the third-party defendant, Colin Little, in state court in Dallas County. The fact is that trial courts routinely grant transfers based on similar or shorter distances. And this court has granted mandamus, previously in a case requiring transfer of just 200 miles. In no event was the district court correct to treat the distance between Dallas and Marshall as negligible. Just as in Volkswagen 1, it is also true that the non-party witnesses located where the collision occurred are outside the Eastern District subpoena power for deposition. And any trial subpoenas for those witnesses would be subject to motions to quash. On the other hand, a venue that enjoys absolute subpoena power for both the depositions and trial is readily available, and that is Dallas. The panel was rightly critical of the district court's classification of this factor as neutral. The fact that the district court can deny motions to quash does not address concerns regarding the convenience of parties and witnesses. As the panel recognized, this rationale simply asserts that the district court has the power and may be able to enforce an option that is inconvenient to the witnesses. The district court's analysis of this factor ignored the court's analysis of the identical factor in Volkswagen 1. In addition, all of the documents and physical evidence related to the accident are located in Dallas. That includes the wreckage of the Volkswagen vehicle. No sources of proof are located in Marshall. The Singletons discussed the location of evidence related to the product's liability claim as distinct from the third-party claim for the accident itself, but that is beside the point, as none of the product's liability evidence is in Marshall or the Eastern District. The fact that some evidence may be in New Jersey or in Germany does not render Marshall more convenient than Dallas. Nor do advances in copying technology render this factor moot. As the panel held, the fact that access to some sources of proof presents a lesser inconvenience now than it might have absent recent developments does not render the factor superfluous. The ultimate question is convenience, which is why the location of the sources of proof is relevant, and not just whether the sources can be produced in another district with less difficulty than may have been the case when the factor was first adopted. This factor certainly favors transfer to some degree, and when added with the other factors favoring transfer, their combined weight is overwhelming, especially as the singletons have identified no countervailing factors. To some extent, the multiple legal errors committed by the trial court overlap with its errors in failing to properly analyze the Pfizer factors. But because each of the legal errors themselves constitutes an abuse of discretion, they warrant separate review. Lacking any valid transfer factor that favored Marshall over Dallas, the district court afforded, quote, paramount consideration, close quote, to the plaintiff's choice of Marshall and refused to transfer on that basis. This was a serious legal error. This court has repeatedly held that the plaintiff's choice of forum in and of itself is neither conclusive nor determinative of the transfer analysis. And the Singletons do not direct the court to any circuit court opinions holding that the plaintiff's choice of forum is, without more, sufficient to overcome a motion to transfer to a more convenient forum. Multiple sister circuits have held, under 1404A, that a plaintiff's choice of forum, supported only by the fact that it was chosen, is not sufficient, and the appellate courts will compel transfer in that instance. And even the Supreme Court has upheld 1404A transfers away from the plaintiff's preferred forum, including even the plaintiff's home forum, on multiple occasions. And in Coring, this court compelled a district court to transfer away from the plaintiff's chosen forum, despite the fact that it was the plaintiff's home forum. Plaintiff's choice of forum is simply never sufficient in itself to warrant denial of a transfer motion. Now, the Singletons complain that the panel erred here by treating the plaintiff's choice of forum as choice of venue as merely the basis for the defendant's burden of proof when seeking transfer under 1404A. But the panel was correct to treat the plaintiff's choice of forum as the starting point in the analysis.
Mr.
rather
Ashby,
than
I assume you're open to questions now.
I am.
In more than 5 minutes, all right.
The panel was correct to treat the
plaintiff. Let me ask you this. What is the standard that this court should use in a writ of mandamus? Abuse of discretion on appeal is one thing, but is abuse of discretion on a mandamus a higher standard somehow, clear abuse of discretion? What's the different standards we should use in a regular appeal where the standard is abuse of discretion and a writ of mandamus where it's clear abuse of discretion? Is there a difference between those two standards?
I think there is a difference between the clear abuse of discretion that's necessary to obtain mandamus relief and an abuse of discretion that may be sufficient to overturn a decision of the trial court on a direct appeal. What the courts have said is that a clear abuse of discretion consists in either clear legal errors, we've articulated at least five in this case, but it also consists, especially in the 1404A analysis, in a clear error of judgment by the trial court in how it weighed and balanced the Pfizer factors. Here we have a case in which none of the Pfizer factors weigh in favor of transfer, and the trial court erred in concluding that those factors were neutral, based not only on the case law, but because the reasoning that the trial judge used effectively read those factors out of the analysis. We submit that that is a sufficiently clear abuse of discretion to warrant mandamus relief in this case.
Counsel, would be there, therefore, your position that any panel that gets a mandamus petition that views the judge's weighing to be incorrect, and therefore made a bad judgment on transfer, not transferring, that would support mandamus and the finding of abuse of discretion?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. It may well be that there could be a number of cases where a trial judge may have erred, but where mandamus relief would not be proper. This is not one of those cases because, again, we're talking about a series of legal errors And we think it's undisputed that they...
Well, let's look at legal errors as opposed to the way, actual weighing. If you look at clear abuse as the denial of a right that you would be entitled to, clearly entitled to, I could see where one could argue that you're entitled to the judge using a correct view of the law and not make legal errors. But how does that interpret, how does that not require that he be mandamus to reconsider it under the proper standard, as opposed to the further proposition that if he would have used the right legal standard, then he would have been compelled and that the defendant or the movement would have had a clear right to have his case in Dallas. How does the use of a wrong legal standard transfer not just from the judge messed up using the wrong legal standard, but because he used the wrong legal standard, therefore venue of necessity must have been granted?
Ultimately, Your Honor, I think the question is, did the legal error make a difference? If the legal error caused the trial judge to erroneously deny a transfer that he should have granted, and in fact, this court has never, in any case in which it has granted mandamus in the 1404A context, it has never remanded to the trial court in order to reassess the factors. And presumably that's because mandamus is an extraordinary remedy, and this court wouldn't grant it if ultimately it were deciding that a transfer factor or the consideration of an improper factor under 1404A ultimately didn't cause the trial judge to reach the wrong decision. And this court has said that it looks closely to the circumstances presented to and the decision-making process used by the trial court. And that would include not just a review of the legal errors, but also an assessment of whether the trial judge has correctly and logically weighed and balanced the 1404A factors. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that the trial judge doesn't have discretion. He certainly does. But we submit that there are instances in which a clear error in judgment in the way that the judge exercises that discretion can be sufficient to warrant mandamus relief. And that is one of those, one of those cases.
There's a difference between abusing and really abusing.
That's correct, Your Honor. The trial court also committed a separate error of law in holding that Volkswagen was not entitled to transfer unless the balance of convenience and justice substantially weighs in favor of transfer. This standard is a vestige of forum nonconvenience jurisprudence. The Supreme Court has said that 1404A permits transfers on a lesser showing than is required under the common law forum nonconvenience doctrine. And this court has held that the burden imposed on defendants by the forum nonconvenience doctrine does not apply in the 1404A context. As the panel held in Viva Kimmy, this court explained that the heavy burden traditionally imposed upon defendants in the forum nonconvenience context was dropped in the 1404A context. Now, the Singletons argue that 1404A and the Supreme Court's decision in Norwood actually expanded or broadened the district court's discretion to refuse to transfer cases. That is simply not so. No case law suggests under 1404A that a district court could decline to transfer a case that it would have been obligated to dismiss under forum nonconvenience.
I think 1404A did give the district court greater discretion to rule in favor of a transfer.
That's correct, Your Honor. What the Supreme Court said in Norwood is that 1404A was not a codification of forum nonconvenience of the common law doctrine, but simply requires the moving party to show that the balance of convenience and justice weighs in favor of transfer. And in that sense, the Supreme Court said that trial judges have broader discretion to grant transfer motions than they had to dismiss cases under forum nonconvenience. But the court never said that that discretion extends to the opposite end of the scale to refuse to deny transfer motions.
And what, to what extent, if any, in considering the plaintiff's choice in this case, did the district court consider the relative speed of getting to trial in the two districts?
The trial judge found that that factor was neutral here, that there would be no difference between the relative burden on the dockets in the Dallas Division and the Marshall Division, and therefore held that that factor was neutral. And all of the parties have agreed that that factor is, in fact, neutral here.
Well, this case is really going to boil down to a battle between the experts, though, isn't it? I mean, you've got a rear-end collision on a freeway in Dallas. Wasn't the judge entitled to look at your list of Dallas witnesses a little askance and say, you know, I really doubt that we're going to need very many fact witnesses in this case?
Well, again, we identified 15 separate witnesses in Dallas, and they include the accident investigator, the treating medical personnel, the medical examiner. We believe that all of those witnesses are highly significant to causation, to liability, to damages. And, in fact, the plaintiffs themselves identify twice the number of witnesses that we identified as being relevant.
Tell me, I mean, the judge wasn't required to agree with that, though, was he? I mean, why wasn't he entitled to take the view that I just proposed to you?
Well, because the objective facts are that these witnesses are important to Volkswagen's claim.
I mean, the judge got this motion before any factual development was done in the case, as I understand it. So he's looking at a bare file, and he's got affidavits from both sides. He's got to use his common sense about what kind of case this is and what it's likely. You know, he's tried product cases before. He knows how they work. Isn't he entitled to use his common sense?
He is, Your Honor. And
well, did the district court say this was a battle of experts in its ruling and in its order?
No. The district court did not say that.
And did he say anything that Judge Davis has put in his mind?
What the trial judge did say is he didn't believe that some of the witnesses that we identified had important testimony. He certainly did say that, but we simply disagree with that. The same argument, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
As a products liability case with in this crash, it was the other person who sailed into the victim's car, pushing it into the other thing. Isn't that entitled to be judged under comparative negligence?
It is, Your Honor. And
so it can't be just a battle. I mean, there may be experts, but it's not going to just be experts about the status of the car. It's experts about what happened in the crash, and that involves witnesses.
Yes, and those witnesses, these Dallas-based witnesses, would address issues that go to liability, to causation, to proportionate fault, and to damages. As this court held in Volkswagen 1, the significance of the third-party defendant and the fact that there is an accident claim here is important. This is not just
In this particular case, the third-party defendant has said it's not inconvenient for him, and presumably whoever comes along with him in this, to try this case in Marshall, which is not what the Volkswagen case, the first Volkswagen case, the judge didn't think about that. In this case, the third-party defendant says, it's all right with me.
That is true, Your Honor. The third-party defendant filed an answer indicating that Marshall was, I believe he said, quote, not inconvenient,
right,
close quote.
Mr. Ashby, what reason, or did the Singletons ever enunciate a reason as to why they filed in Marshall?
I don't know why they filed in Marshall. My speculation is...
is there anything in the record, or were they ever asked by the judge, or did they make a statement as to why they selected Marshall?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Not that I'm aware of. But to answer your question, Judge King, the question ultimately here in the transfer analysis is Dallas more convenient than Marshall? And the fact that Colin Little might file an answer represented by a lawyer in Marshall indicating that Marshall is not inconvenient certainly doesn't establish that it's more convenient than Dallas. And for that reason, we don't believe that that should factor into this
question. Convenient for whom, then?
Convenient for the parties and the witnesses. But it's convenience overall for the whole case. And in this case, because there's not only a complete lack of nexus between the facts of this case and Marshall, and a complete lack of relationship between the plaintiffs and Marshall, that the more convenient forum, the clearly more convenient forum, is Dallas. And for that reason, we think the case should be transferred. My time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir. You have time for rebuttal. Mr. Siegel.
May it please the court, my name is Martin Siegel. I represent the Singleton family. I plan to devote the beginning of my time to remarks, but certainly, I hope, not the first 15 minutes, hopefully something shorter than that. There are two questions that, in our view, are at the heart of this case. The first question is simply, who is going to decide transfer motions? Will it be district judges in the exercise of their discretion who are closer to the facts, closer to the habits of these cases, closer to their own trials and their own dockets? Or will it be panels of this court sitting at the remove of New Orleans using the device of mandamus to decide venue questions? The second question that's at the heart of this appeal is whether this court will adhere to a body of precedent for decades, as well as Congress's policy choice in 1391 that the plaintiffs deserve a broad choice of venue, and adhere to that by reaffirming the principle that the plaintiff's choice of forum has weight in the 1404A balancing. On the first point, having to do with trial court discretion, this is an area where trial courts are given broad latitude. And they're given broad latitude both because the very text of 1404A is permissive. It says that district judges may transfer cases, not that they shall. And they're also given that discretion for the prudential reason that these decisions are simply better made by district courts. They're a matter of trial management. They're a matter of case administration. District judges are closer to these questions. They've seen them before in all of their guises, usually. Indeed, in this case, we have a trial judge who, for 30 years, was a product liability defense lawyer, and who, for many years on the bench, has handled these cases, seen them, and knows them. So these are decisions that are better made by district judges, and a number of decisions of this court and really all courts have recognized that. Curtailing this discretion through the use of mandamus is unwise in our view for a couple of reasons. First, it really cuts against the purposes of 1404A. The purpose of 1404A is to streamline cases, make them more efficient, make them quicker, make them less costly. Frequent resort to mandamus litigation in the 1404A setting contravenes those values, and we would respectfully submit that this case is a poster child for that problem. We're now in our second year of litigating where the trial is going to be held at two levels of the federal system. The other reason that curtailing the discretion is inadvisable is Congress's prescription on interlocutory appeals. These decisions are simply not supposed to be interlocutorily appealable. And to have an interlocutory appeal and to have them frequently under the name of mandamus contravenes Congress's express policy against interlocutory appeals in this setting. This case is certainly not mandamus worthy, and I think we know that by looking at the other instances where this court has granted mandamus relief. It's not like In re Cragar or the Atlantic Coastline decision where you had multiple transfers and the court granted mandamus in order to protect the jurisdiction of the courts, nothing like those cases. It's not like Horseshoe Entertainment or the first Volkswagen decision where the district judge applied the wrong factors, applied factors that are not supposed to be part of the analysis, such as location of counsel, and didn't apply factors that are supposed to be part of the analysis, such as third-party witnesses and third-party convenience. It's not like the legal errors made in those cases. It's not even like the Coring decision, where the factual imbalance, the facts favoring transfer, were so dramatic that the defendant could legitimately claim that he was deprived of a fair trial. This case is much more analogous to the Gulf, Santa Fe, and Colorado Railway case, where the plaintiff filed suit in a location that was 360 miles from where the plaintiff lived, from where the witnesses were, from where the facts arose. And yet this court summarily denied mandamus in that case. And the reason it did is because the district judge there had held the hearing, had looked at the factors, had made his decision right or wrong. And it simply wasn't an extraordinary case that demanded mid-case intervention through the device of mandamus. Respectfully, this case is the same. The fact that judges of this court or that other district judges may have decided this transfer question differently had they been sitting originally and considered it there does not make it mandamus worthy. At most, it makes it an error. Turning to the second question that's at issue here, the role of the plaintiff's choice in the 1404A balancing, in the Norwood decision, the Supreme Court held that although it's true that district courts are permitted, that's the word that was used, permitted, not required, but permitted to exercise their discretion to transfer a case on a showing of lesser inconvenience. Nonetheless, Norwood was clear that the plaintiff's choice of forum remains a factor to be considered. That was reiterated in the Stewart Organization versus RICO case. And since Norwood, at least by our count, if we've got it correctly, there are 9 decisions of this court that say either that the plaintiff's choice is a factor to be weighed against the others in the balancing, or that say the balance of those other factors has to tip strongly toward transfer. That is an established body of law in this circuit for decades. And indeed, this circuit is hardly alone. That is the basic background rule, the basic way in which the plaintiff's choice of forum is treated in every circuit in the United States. You will see in the circuit opinions having to do with this that enunciation of the standard as an introduction repeatedly. It is probably not an exaggeration to say that every federal district court at one time or another in the United States has applied that rule in the 60 years since 1404A was enacted. That's the basic rule, and if this court departs from it in the fashion of the second panel, it will be alone, on a limb, treating the plaintiff's choice of forum in a way different than the other courts in the United States do. Now, Volkswagen and some of the amici urge a rule that's a little bit different from what the panel articulated, which really boils down to something akin to a per se rule that would say if the plaintiff doesn't live where the cause of action was filed or if the claims arose elsewhere, then this court, or district courts rather, should use 1404A and find essentially that that's per se inconvenient and that the case has to be transferred. That would be a contravention of Congress's will as expressed through 1391. It is not part of 1391 that plaintiffs have to file their cases where they live. It is not part of 1391 that the case has to be filed where the claims arose or no more than 100 miles away from where one of the parties has been able to identify a couple of fact witnesses. Congress has made the decision that plaintiffs have broad choice of venue, and the Supreme Court in Ferens and in Van Dusen reminded us that 1404A is not to be used to constrict the plaintiff's choice of venue under 1391. The other problem with establishing such a per se rule is that it cuts against the Supreme Court's admonition in the Stewart case and earlier from Gilbert that these are supposed to be flexible, individualized, case-by-case inquiries. That's the way that 1404A has to relate to 1391. The way to avoid conflict between the two is not to set per se rules as to where the plaintiff lives or where the facts arose, but rather at every turn to remind district courts that it's within their discretion to weigh these factors and that they must make fact-intensive, individualized, flexible, and case-by-case decisions. Now, we submit that what Volkswagen asks in this case is essentially a reweighing of factors. And indeed, Mr. Ashby began his argument by saying that the district court had erred in its analysis of weighing those factors. What Volkswagen really wants is some more weight put on one part of the scale, some more weight given to the presence of the witnesses, some more weight given to some of those factors, and less weight given to the factor that supports the plaintiff's choice, and less attention paid to the connections that do exist between this case and the Eastern District of Texas, namely the fact that one of the plaintiffs died, a resident of the Eastern District of Texas, that 2 of the 3 vehicles involved in the collision were from the Eastern District of Texas, the fact that the plaintiffs lived in the Eastern District of Texas before or at the time of this accident, and less weight placed on the plaintiff's choice. That exercise has to be seen for what it is, which is reweighing. It's nothing other than that, and since the 1950s, this court has held in mandamus cases that it will not simply reweigh the factors. In the end, the convenience that's served by granting the petition, if we look past the paper and past the argument, boils down to little more than a couple of extra hours in the car for two people, Irene Soto and Kenny Wigington, even giving Volkswagen the benefit of the doubt that they'll actually be called to testify. That's simply not worth the 2 years of litigation. It's not worth postponing the trial. It's not worth the stay of discovery. It's not worth the attention that's been spent on this question. And it certainly isn't worth abandoning decades of precedent in this court about 1404A and mandamus. I now like to take questions.
Mr. Siegel, let me ask you, you made reference to the fact that Judge Ward, who I'm sure we all agree is a very able and hardworking and experienced district judge, you made reference to the fact that he was counsel for many years in products liability cases, and I assume that you said that because you think it matters to us, and so I'm going to ask you about that. Take a hypothetical situation in which someone is a newly appointed federal district judge, and his or her experience consisted entirely of being a criminal defense attorney and has never tried or had any experience with civil matters, much less products liability cases. My question of you is, would that or should that matter to us in reviewing a petition for writ of mandamus?
I don't really think so, Your Honor. I don't think that would have much formal role. I think the reality is that by the time people have become federal district judges and spend any time in that job, they quickly face these motions. They're very common motions. It's obviously not, for whatever it's worth, it's not the situation we have in this case. But I think Judge Davis had it right when asking whether or not we ought to look at how district judges view this question. And the reason I think Judge Davis has it right is because the Supreme Court in Gilbert has that line that says, you know, the able and experienced.
A forum nonconvenience case.
That's true, Your Honor, but I think it's equally, there's no reason why it's not equally applicable here. What the Supreme Court said in Gilbert is, we know that the able and experienced district judge understands that parties are usually able to try their cases with fewer witnesses than
their what I'm interested in is the plaintiff's choice of venue. And what do you understand? I mean, it's, you know, I wrote the opinion in this, the panel opinion, and I mean, I would recognize clearly that the choice of venue has some, of the plaintiff's choice of venue certainly has a role to play here. Now, how did we, in that case, become an outlier in all of the 12 circuits?
Because the panel opinion seems to say that the only relevance of the plaintiff's choice is to say that then the defendant has the burden of persuasion of showing that good cause exists and that the factors have to
right,
be.
Now, what is your contention? What weight should it be given?
Our contention is that this court, through nine decisions, has said it's a factor to be weighed against the others. In other words,
well, do we say that? I think we say that as well, don't we? It's certainly a factor to be weighed if it creates a burden.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that's not how we read it, and I'll try to explain why. I think the reason we didn't read it that way is because, first of all, that burden of persuasion always exists on any movement. Anytime a movement seeks relief, he's got that burden of persuasion, and that defendant has always had that burden of persuasion through 1404 right. cases, even at the same time that he's had the burden that it's
okay,
been
now
a substantive
what is the
factor.
Weight, but again, I mean, getting back to it, how would you describe the weight that it should be given?
It's one factor just like the others. To be balanced with the others. That's what this court said only 5 years ago in Horseshoe Entertainment.
So in your judgment, it is only one of several factors that is entitled to no more weight than any of the others.
Exactly, Your Honor. It's one of the many factors, and it gets weighed and balanced with the others. But what that means is that you can then have a case like this one, we would submit, where on one side of the scale you have that factor, and on the other side of the scale you have some of the factors that tilt mildly toward transfer. In that situation, a district judge is well within the very broad discretion the district judge is given to find, well, this is kind of a wash.
I mean, I don't disagree with you, and I don't think that our panel disagrees. I mean, that mandamus is an extraordinary remedy for an extraordinary case. And I suppose the panel just saw it when Marshall, Texas, had absolutely no connection whatsoever with the case, the facts, the parties, or anything else. Then under those circumstances, it was an extraordinary case deserving extraordinary remedy. That's all. I mean, I don't think, as far as I'm concerned, It is totally consistent with all of the precedent that we've ever decided. It did not mean to get outside that precedent. It did mean to clarify to some extent the choice of forum or the choice of venue, because that was all over the place, and you'd have to admit that, I think.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, there's no doubt when you have any body of law that involves multiple decisions, you start to get different verbal formulations, and you get twists and turns here and there. So I don't disagree.
Try to straighten that out.
Fair enough, Your Honor. We don't quarrel with that. We just think that if you looked at the body of law over those 9 or 10 decisions, it seemed to us there was a break in the panel's decision. And something else I should have mentioned a moment ago that made us think that, which is if you get to the end of the second panel's decision, what it says is no factor favors Marshall. Well, if the plaintiff's choice is treated as a factor, as it was in Horseshoe Entertainment and the other decisions we cite.
Perhaps we should say nothing other than choice of venue of the plaintiff's counsel favored Marshall. Well, that would be true. And it shouldn't outweigh every factor. You've just indicated that in your answer to me. You said it's only one among
and
many.
Isn't it correct, Mr. Siegel, that in Gulf Oil, the court, in fact, upheld a dismissal for forum nonconvenience of precisely a forum selection, not a forum shopping case?
Well, Your Honor, we don't, I mean, Mr. Ashby kind of alluded to that, too.
They did, right.
Absolutely. And of course, we're not saying that a court never can transfer a case away from where the plaintiff has chosen.
Looking seriously at this, what's extraordinary, I have two concerns. And one of them is that in looking at a number of decisions by Judge Ward, and there are dozens of them, on transfer motions, in a few cases, he says that the travel distance between Marshall and Dallas or Sherman is at least 150 miles, and he acknowledges it may require an overnight stay. And he acknowledges it may impose, I'm talking about other decisions, hardship on witnesses. In a number of other cases, he discounts that completely. Well, Marshall, Texas, as if it's, you know, Hobby Airport. All right, now, that, you know, what do you do about the judge himself? And there's no obvious difference among these cases, except you got witnesses who would have to travel those distances. Okay, the other point is, if 150 miles over what we know is not an interstate highway from Dallas into the deep heart of East Texas is not inconvenient, why should anybody in Houston who prefers to try a case in Beaumont or Lufkin not file, and therefore the Eastern District will become the venue of choice for Houston cases?
Well, Your Honor, I think what the court said in Volkswagen 1 and the way it seems to have been transmuted in Volkswagen 2 in the second panel's decision, it started out as a recognition that this is a sliding scale, and when you get beyond 100, the inconvenience goes up and up and up a little bit. 150 is only, if you look at the travel time, you know, that's about 45 minutes more in the car. It's radically, Your Honor mentioned Gulf, it's radically different than Virginia versus New York. It's radically different than some of the other venue choices one can make here in the United States. It's not different than the Gulf, Santa Fe, and Colorado Railway, where it was 360 miles. It's not different than Beach Aircraft or the Mills case, where this court said.
So basically, the fact that Judge Ward says one thing in one case and says it's inconvenient, and in the other case he says it doesn't make any difference, is of no moment. You're just going to defend what he said here.
I think what we'd try to defend is the larger point of how inconvenient it is when you start to get a little bit beyond 100, and really whether a district judge can use his discretion to say, well, yeah, that's we're getting beyond 100, maybe that's a little more inconvenient, but this is a melange of factors, it's a sliding scale. Certainly if it were 400 or 500 miles, then that factor weighs more heavily. I mean, we just have some factors.
If this had been, say, in El Paso, everything that occurred in Dallas had occurred in El Paso, would you say that the judge abused his discretion if he denied a motion to transfer?
I would say two things to that, Your Honor. I would start by saying absolutely that's a better case because this is all it's all.
Would
on
you say
scale.
Mandamus could reach that case?
The reason I might have trouble with that is because still we only have two witnesses, and if the court will let me, I want to address, because Mr. Ashby spent part of his argument talking about all these witnesses who were Dallas local officials and how important that is. I want to address that subject.
Did you list 30 witnesses?
No, Your Honor. What we did is we responded, as you're supposed to Rule 26. Those are not witnesses who we believe we're going to call. Those are people in discovery who have knowledge. Those disclosures, as the Court well knows, are always as overbroad as a party can make them so that no one's been left out. That has nothing to do with who we think, whose convenience really ought to be taken into account here. The witnesses that Volkswagen is relying on, they didn't name them. They didn't tell us what they know. They didn't tell us what areas they might know about. They didn't connect it up to anything relevant in this case. They didn't tell us if they opposed going to Marshall. Now, it is Hornbook law, and you can find this in Wright and Miller, and you can find it in Moore's, that you have to do more than just list names on a piece of paper in an affidavit from their investigator. The district court has to not let this become a battle of the numbers. The district court is entitled.
Did the judge say something about that?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. What he said is we don't have enough information to judge whether these are key witnesses. That's the phrase you see in Wright and Miller because it's taken from all the case law.
Mr. Siegel, in answering Judge Jolly's question, you seem to open the door to some proper case in which it might, that mandamus could lie. His question was specifically in regard to the witnesses. So my question to you is this. I'm just trying to figure out what your position is. I take it from leaving the door open, it is not your position that it's always sufficient just if the district judge properly lists what the appropriate factors are and indicates that he or she has considered each of those factors, that in fact it is appropriate for us to go beyond that to look at least to some extent to how the judge, having articulated the proper factors, dealt with those factors under the facts and circumstances of the case.
Your Honor, I think the answer to your question is found in this Court's opinion in Knoll versus Dick, where at the end of the discussion it says, we don't find that the defendant showed that his right to a fair trial was prejudiced. So I think when we're not analyzing legal errors or jurisdiction, we're just saying, is there a reweighing error here? Is there a mistake in weighing the right factors? Then I think it's pretty exacting review, and it has to be, is this so bad that the defendant's right to a fair trial has been prejudiced? That's also, by the way, what appears in Gulf Oil. If you look at the discussion of the factors in Gulf Oil, it says, you know, where the witnesses are, this and that. And then it says, and all the other things that go into a fair trial. And that language is quoted in Coring. I think the best.
Just a minute. I think that was a forum nonconvenience in which the remedy was dismissal. And here the federal courts have been very clear and the Supreme Court has been clear that all we are doing is transferring from one courtroom to the other. You will have the same witnesses. You'll have the same law. You'll have the same forum. You will just have a different venue, and that is all.
But respectfully, Your Honor, I think what the Supreme Court said in Norwood, I mean, the reason we still looked at Gilbert is because what the Supreme Court said in Norwood. And in Norwood, it said it's the same factors. Granted, you're permitted to exercise your discretion more broadly, but it's the same substantive factors, and the plaintiff's choice is still to be considered. So I guess if I'm quoting Gilbert, it comes through Norwood into 1404A. But we certainly don't disagree with Your Honor that the change is that a district court is permitted to exercise broader discretion. If I could, I was going to return to Judge Smith's question, but I'm sorry.
If you haven't answered.
Okay. Well, all I wanted to say in addition to Judge Smith's question is we have a guidepost. When you ask, I've opened the door a little bit, and you know, what's the right case where maybe that's appropriate? I think we have two easy guideposts. One is the Coring decision, where there really weren't legal errors involved. The court just went through the factors and said, there's a plant in Oklahoma. These people are in Mississippi. It's a great distance. You might need to look at the plant. There's congestion issues, lots of witnesses there. It was really dramatic. So Coring is probably a good benchmark for when you can do what you're suggesting, Judge Smith. And on the other end, you have Gulf, Santa Fe, and Colorado Railway, where the distance is smaller, 360 miles, where the plaintiff doesn't live there and the witnesses aren't there, but the court says, come on, this is broad discretion, this is within the discretion of the court. So I think those guideposts and asking, can you get a fair trial, is the way to analyze that, respectfully, Your Honor.
1404A is not speak to fair trial, does it? It's convenience of witness and parties. It doesn't say a word about fair trial.
Well, I think the question was, what's the what's the standard we should look at on mandamus? I mean, it's not simply 1404A. It's now a decision's been made by the district court. And when is it so wrong? When is it so egregiously an abuse of discretion that we're going to overturn it in the middle of the case by this court? And that's where you get into what's an extraordinary case.
But measured by the statutory requirements, which is convenience of the witness and party,
I think
doesn't have to do with fair trial.
I think in a mandamus context, you're asking when is – certainly a district judge – applying 1404A originally shouldn't ask, well, this has got to be so inconvenient that you're not going to get a fair trial. Absolutely. But by the time it's on mandamus, it's a totally different analysis.
Why would we wouldn't even have a record on fair trial. You're correct. The district court shouldn't be asking that question.
Right.
So we don't have a record on fair trial.
Well, no, respectfully, Your Honor, you know who the witnesses are. You know it's 150 miles. You know what they've said about coming to Marshall. Absolutely, the court can analyze this and ask, can Volkswagen get a fair trial?
I'm interested in your claim that you're not getting a fair trial. Are you saying that you could not get a fair trial in the federal courts of Dallas, Texas? Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Then fair trial obviously has no consideration whatsoever in this case, does it?
No. What I'm saying is once the district court has already made a decision, the district court made a decision to not transfer. So now we're here on mandamus. Everybody acknowledges it's an extraordinary remedy.
We're under mandamus under 1404A for the convenience of the witnesses and the parties and the interest of justice. And those are the considerations because I thought I agreed with you that we should keep mandamus very narrow, focused exactly on the issues that are presented to us, and recognize the fact that the district court is in much better position to decide these questions than us and reserve it only for extraordinary cases. I thought I agreed with you on that.
We do agree on that. I think we got off on this discussion of a fair trial because Judge Smith had asked me, when do you have a case where there's not a legal error necessarily, but the factors have been so inadequately or inaccurately weighed that you have an abuse of discretion? So that's where I think, as this comes from Knoll versus Dick.
That's a fair ruling, not a fair trial.
Respectfully,
a fair ruling on the 1404A.
We're just relying on what this court said in Knoll versus Dick, where it came to the end of the discussion and said, well, this is maybe it could have gone either way, but it's not so bad that the party didn't get a fair trial. I think that's the standard that we would submit as applicable.
That would be the question on review. If these questions ever got to an appellate review on appeal on the merits, that's probably exactly what the courts would say.
Well, but if anything, Your Honor, mandamus is more extraordinary than general review.
Oh, I totally agree.
Right. So I mean, the standard has to be all the more stringent for overturning a district court decision on
totally
mandamus.
I totally agree.
Mr. Siegel, get back to your point, if you would, about what your view is of the witnesses from Dallas that will be required to testify in the case.
Thank you, Your Honor. What Volkswagen did is list categories of people like the record driver or EMS personnel. They listed the medical examiner. The district court is faced with a decision here and has to decide, well, what's really going to impact the convenience of this trial? And he can't do that unless he knows something about those witnesses. And again, it's been uniform in the treatises that we don't want this to be a battle of the numbers. Any party could, you know, we could have listed everyone who lived on the block of this little girl who died and said, well, gee, they all knew her. We're going to call them all as damages witnesses. You don't do that. You have to look at who really the key witnesses are, and you can't do that unless the parties provided information about them. Volkswagen didn't give us an affidavit. They certainly had an able investigator who went around talking to people. We don't know who these people are. We don't know what relevance they have. We don't know if they want to go to Marshall or not. So the district court was correct to say, I don't know what to do with these people. I can't consider them. They don't have a lot of weight.
Counsel, I think you've answered that question. If you're not, go ahead.
No, I have.
You have used two different terms. You have used once, you've used the term, all they did was list. And then there's another suggestion that we know what their role is. For instance, they're an EMS driver or they're a witness to the scene. So that suggests more than a list. What is it specifically that was in the matters that were presented with reference to these people other than some characterization? What is there about what they would testify to, how it would be an inconvenience, that it was an inconvenience to them? Any statements from these people?
Absolutely no information about any of that. What I mean by a list is there was an affidavit from an expert who said the following people are in Dallas: EMS driver, wrecker, So that's it. I mean, we know they're a wrecker, but we don't know if they have anything at all to say in this case. It's unreasonable to believe
Mr.
that.
Mr. Siegel, before you run out of time, let me ask you. The factor to be considered as to whether the plaintiff's choice of form is balanced accurately and weighed correctly, it needs to be based on a reasonable preference. Have you articulated, or your client articulated, any reason as to why you chose Marshall so that that could go into the decision-making process?
Well, Your Honor, I might take a little bit of issue with the notion that it has to be based on something reasonable. It's based on 1391. It's based on Congress's choice that we're allowed to file there. But to answer the question is,
you can't file in Santa Fe. You have to have, I would think, some reasonable preference.
We can file wherever under the decision Congress has made. It's not a question for this Court. It's Congress's
decision.
All right.
What is your reason for filing there? What was your preference?
I think what was thought is, I mean, you see the phrase home turf in some of these decisions? Did the plaintiff sue on his home turf? These plaintiffs thought that this was their home turf. It's where they used to live, in the Eastern District of Texas, and
they didn't live
within the division. Fair enough, of course, Your Honor, not within the division. But they lived in that district, and then they're picking, you know, because the venue laws allow them to, they're selecting options within that district. And I think they liked this Court because it's handled products cases before, because it makes prompt discovery rulings, because you have a time to trial.
Is this ever made known to the district judge? Was this a part of the record?
I don't believe the district judge asked that question. I don't believe it is a part of the record. But we made what Congress has sanctioned, which is a choice about where we wanted to try the case. It's only 100. It's not far away. It's where they used to live. And I think it's worth pointing out that Volkswagen, of course, made a choice too, which is, you know, Volkswagen, with all respect to Volkswagen, I don't think they've litigated this for 2 years because of the convenience of Irene Soto or Kenny Wigington. Volkswagen has chosen a forum through 1404A, as the plaintiff does through 1391.
Well, thank you, Mr. Siegel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ashby, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Siegel indicates that, in his view, the discretion that should be exercised, that is to be exercised by the trial court here, should essentially be unchecked if the proper factors are considered and no improper factors are considered by the trial court. That is at odds, again, with the decisions of every circuit court in the country. Every court to review the 1404A question has held not just that the trial court's discretion is subject to review for failing to consider the proper factors or failing to correctly construe the statute, but also in how the judge weighs and analyzes the Pfizer factors. Discretion here certainly is broad, but it's not unlimited. There is no right for a trial judge to exercise his discretion in an illogical or unreasonable manner, and we submit that that is what happened in this case. And I would point the court to 1404A was enacted in...
You wouldn't contend, though, that an appellate court should really review all of the factors in a mandamus proceeding under 1404A and reweigh everything the judge said, would you?
Absolutely not. I think it goes to the decision-making process of the trial judge. That's the point at which the Court of Appeals may intervene. If we had a case where the trial judge said that there were 7 witnesses in this forum and 12 witnesses in that forum, and I'm exercising my discretion to transfer or not transfer, there's no question that this court would not review that case on mandamus. But
well, it seems to me, I mean, for us to rule, say, in your favor, what kind of determination would the appellate court make whether to give a more thorough review to a transfer order than one that we should not give a thorough review to?
Well, again, I think it depends. As this court has said in numerous 1404A cases, the court looks at the decision-making process and the circumstances that were presented to the trial judge.
But not in every case, surely.
Not for purposes of granting mandamus relief, that is correct. But at least in terms of determining whether the court would grant mandamus, it would look at those factors. But certainly, most cases are never going to warrant mandamus relief because what you typically have are factors that weigh somewhat in favor of keeping the case in the forum if the judge has denied a transfer motion.
Counsel, in the absence of some statement by your investigator or an affidavit, The fact that a witness exists, why does it necessarily follow that that witness would be aggrieved or think that he would be aggrieved or think that he would be inconvenienced? Counsel is telling us that the witness list that you gave or the investigator's report didn't even say that these people didn't want to go or that it would be hard for them or that they would miss work or that it was too far to go or it would keep them from participating in the trial. Is that true?
That is not true. First of all, there were two affidavits that we obtained from key witnesses, the accident witness as well as the lead investigator, the lead police investigator. We submitted those affidavits along with an affidavit of an investigator who went out and determined the residences of each of the witnesses that we believed would be relevant to the case. We submitted that. Then, in addition, there was a detailed interview, telephone interview, that was conducted by our investigator of the lead eyewitness in the case, and that was submitted.
But that didn't answer my question. What did it say? Did it say those people would find it inconvenient to go to Marshall? Did they say it would be impossible for them to be, that it would cause hardship for them? In other words, is this all assumed, or was there anything there that was presented to the judge that actually said that?
We absolutely did say that in the affidavits that were filed. Now, it is true that we only filed two affidavits, and to be completely candid with the court. But our position is if we file two affidavits that indicate that it is burdensome for witnesses to travel from Dallas to Marshall, that it's proper to conclude also that all of the other witnesses in Dallas would also be inconvenienced by having to travel to Marshall. Mr. Siegel also addresses the question of whether the plaintiff's choice of forum is I'm sorry, I'm out of time. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.